So we left off last time. We finished the first Mishnah, which is on Daf Beis Amud Aleph, and we started talking about a separate case of marriage, not regular marriage, but a case of levirate marriage, what's called Yibum. And the last line of the Mishnah, we'll just review it, the last two lines of the Mishnah, right before the Gemara ends, which is on line, at the end of line 6, Hayivama Niknes Babia, the sister-in-law, the surviving wife, the widow, who has to marry her brother-in-law, she can only enter into that marriage. She's only acquired through marital relations. V'kona es atzma, and she can acquire her own independence, meaning she can go ahead and, without marrying her brother-in-law, be freed to marry anyone she wants, either performing chalitza, which was the other option, following the procedure known as chalitza, or ubimisa sayavim, if the brother-in-law happens to pass away before he has an opportunity to perform yibum, so then she would be free, just like if the husband had no brothers. Let's say the husband was an only child. Let's say the husband only had sisters, so there would never be a situation of yibum or chalitza. You have to have all the qualifications have to be there. So what I wanted to do is take a look at the Rashi. The heading of the Rashi is Bibia. It's on the inside.
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to follow on this.
So I'll get you a copy.
Yeah.
It's on the inside of the page. There's always Rashi. And I think I boxed it, the heading.
Perfect, thanks.
So Rashi is defining the procedure of this case of Yibum. So Rashi said, Bibia, liyos ki'ishto l'chol davar. Once the levirate marriage is performed and the brother-in-law and sister-in-law are intimate, instantly she becomes like his wife, l'chol davar, they are fully married. They are fully married like any married couple you know. She'im ba l'garsha, acharkach, ein atzricha emenu chalitza elaget. Let's say the relationship doesn't work out, and the two of them want to go their separate ways. Chalitza will no longer be an option. They'll have to go through the normal divorce proceedings with a get, just like everybody else. But the Mishnah only gave us one option. As opposed to regular marriage, we had said that there are three options. Most of us, not most of us, all of us, when we got married, we gave something of value, a ring, as our practice is, to our wives. That's kesef. The Mishnah also gave an option of shtar, that we could have written on a piece of paper, you are hereby betrothed to me, give her the piece of paper in front of witnesses, it would have worked. And in the times of the Mishnah, although it was condemned in the times of the Gemara, you could have even done it with intimate relations. So entering a regular marriage is three ways. Entering this levirate marriage is only through intimate relations. So Rashi's picking up on that point, and he's telling us, Aval shtar v'kesef, going through the means of either extending the document or by means of giving her something of value, ein mo'ilim ba min ha-Torah. That will not work on a biblical level to affect a marriage relationship between this sister-in-law and brother-in-law. Ella, rather, let's say you decided to give her something of value, midrabanan, it would work on a rabbinic level. We know that there are certain times things take effect on a biblical level and certain times things take effect on a rabbinic level. So if the brother-in-law would take a ring and give it to his sister-in-law, that would affect nothing on a biblical level, but it would on a rabbinic level. Ditikun de mahani ba ma'amar. Because the rabbis enacted that it would work what's called ma'amar. Ma'amar, the root of the word is amar. The root of the word is to say something. Ma'amar, or maimer, as you know, the more yeshivish way to say it, maimer, is that the brother-in-law is saying something and giving something of value or saying something on the piece of paper. And what it accomplishes, according to Rashi, seems to be kedarmina biyavamas, aval eno gomer ba liyos yorsha. This giving the sister-in-law something of value, that will not make you inherit her. If let's say after the brother-in-law gives her something of value and he hasn't been intimate with her yet, and she were to die, he wouldn't have rights to her inheritance. She's not his full wife on a biblical level. Umatamala, let's say he was a Kohen and she died, he would not be able to become impure if she died because she's not his wife yet. If all he did was extend something of value. Velo leporta minachalitza, and that wouldn't exempt her from chalitza. If let's say after giving her something of value, he decided or she decided that they're no longer interested, she would still have to get chalitza before being free. So what does it accomplish? Why would one brother-in-law do that? Ela leposla al shar achiv. Let's say there are multiple brother-in-laws. Let's say the guy has four brothers, and he dies without any children. And now his wife is supposed to marry one of the three brothers. So what Rashi's making it sound like from here is, why would, let's say I'm the middle brother. I've always been that middle child. I never get anything. Why would I want to extend to her something of value? I would want to extend to her something of value because if I give her something of value and say, Hare at mikudeshesli, rabbinically I've now reserved her, and my other brothers can't do the levirate marriage. I'm the only one who gets a chance to do the levirate marriage. And when we do the levirate marriage, we'll have to follow what the Mishnah said, which is doing it through intimate relations. So when you read this Rashi, and when I read this Rashi, when I studied Kiddushin the first time and the second time, and even this time, I always thought, I'm going to be honest here, I always thought that this idea of Mimer, this idea of the brother-in-law extending something of value, is this plan B option. Let's see, for whatever reason, he couldn't be intimate with her, but he wants to make sure that his other brother doesn't steal her. So it seems like they give him an option, a way to reserve, that he'll get to be the one to do the mitzvah of Yibam. And how does he do that? By extending her something of value. Why Rashi explained it with these words, I'm still not sure. But the simple understanding of this Rashi does not provide you the full picture of what this rabbinic enactment was. If you take a look on your source sheet that I gave out, the separate source sheet.
And when he says those words, she has to accept it, or that just...
She would have to accept it. It would kind of be like the rabbinic version of regular marriage. Right. She would have to accept it. Reserve her
without her accepting anyway.
Right. Now, what we're going to see is it's going to be complicated. Technically, she doesn't have to be knowledgeable about the actual act of intimacy when it comes to the levirate marriage. Levirate marriage is a quirky law in that she doesn't necessarily have to be aware of the fact. Meaning, let's say she was in a dark room and she didn't know who it was, and it turned out it was her brother-in-law. They would be married. And we're going to talk about that. So let's hold off on that.
Okay.
So source number one is a very short line from the Gemara in Maseches Yevamos. Yevamos is known to be one of the more challenging tractates. It's one of the ones that scares me. There's a saying, there's a teaching that Mashiach is going to come riding on a, like an, and he's going to look like an ani on a chamor, like a poor person riding on a donkey. What does that mean? So it's explained that the word ani is spelled ayin, nun, yud. And what does it stand for? It stands for the three hardest mesechtas. Apparently, according to this teaching, the three hardest mesechtas are Erevin, which deal with all the laws of the Erev, and it's very complex with the measurements and everything. Nida, which deals mostly with the laws of purity and impurity that existed in the times of the temple, where a woman who was a Nida wouldn't even be allowed to prepare food if her husband was a Kohen, because he's not allowed to eat impure food. Aspects that don't necessarily deal with what we... It does deal with the modern day keeping of the laws of family purity. And the Yud stands for Yevamos. So the teaching is that when will Mashiach come? When the Jewish people are studying the three hardest Masechtas, then Mashiach will come. So maybe we'll have a little kiyum, a little fulfillment in that. We're learning a line, one line from Maseches Yevamos. To Amar Rav Huna, Rav Huna taught in source number one on the sheet, Mitzias Yevama. What is the optimal way to perform the levirate marriage? Mikadesh, first you should do regular kiddushin, meaning with something of value or with a document, the acharkach boel, and then you should have your intimate relations. It should not be that the first aspect of the first part of your relationship should not take place with intimacy. It's not proper, says Rav Huna. This is not what you got. When we learned the Rashi, it sounded like Rashi is saying, what's the focus of this Mimer? The focus is that if they're multiple brothers, so he'll be able to reserve her. Leposel, the Rashi's language was, leposta al shar achiv. She won't be able to go with the other brothers. Rav Huna says, no. The optimal way to perform Yibam is first do this rabbinic idea of Kiddushin with her. It'll only work on a rabbinic level. And then you'll handle the intimacy. And this is brought down in source number two, in Halacha. The basic book of Halacha, the Shulchan Aruch, is divided into four sections. The section that deals with all the laws of marriage and women is called Evan HaEzer. And in the Halachos of Yibam, in source number two, in Simen Kuf Samach Vav Sif Beis, the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Kairo writes as follows. Min HaTorah, Ein Tzarech Lekadsha Elabayla. According to biblical law, if you read the pasuk in last week's parsha, in parsha Kisetze, you don't have to do kiddushin. You don't have to affect betrothal with the sister-in-law. Elabayla. All you have to do is be intimate with her. But it was our sages. Now we know who the sage is. Who's the sage? Rav Huna. Rav Huna is the sage. Our sages established shelo yavo eleha, that you should not be intimate with her until you betroth her in front of two witnesses, bekesef ubishtar, either with something of value or a document. The hu nikra maimer. This is called maimer. The im baile below maimer. And if you would go the biblical route and only want to be intimate with her without first performing betrothal with her, kana, it would work. You would acquire her. The ain tzarach lachzor lekadesh. We wouldn't make you go back and actually betroth her. But umakinos umakas mardis. We'd give you rabbinic lashes because you violated the laws of the rabbis. And this is something that the rabbis came about, and they said that even though the Torah said it was okay, in our days it's not proper. It's not proper that you should enter into the levirate marriage that way. First, you should go about it in a rabbinic way of first giving her something of value and saying the words Hariat Mekudeshesli, doing the normal acts of betrothal, and then you'll be intimate with her. It's kind of mimicking the real marriage. And what it really does, and this is fascinating, is that the same way that our Mishnah says there are three ways into marriage, regular case, no one's been married before, nobody died, it's a regular case, man and a woman, you have three ways. You could do it with kesef, with a shtar, or with bia. So the Gemara comes later on, a couple of pages from here, and says that in the times of the Gemara, they outlawed the bia because it was considered to be improper to enter into a marriage that way. It wasn't the proper way, and if you did enter in a marriage that way, you would get a rabbinic form of lashes.
How could the rabbis overrule the Torah?
It's not overruling the Torah. It's putting up. It falls into the category of putting up a protective fence around the Torah. It's not overruling the Torah because, like it says, meaning it's not going to be
lashes for it.
Rabbinic lashes.
Rabbinic.
Right, but the Torah gives the power to the rabbis.
To me, it seems pretty clear. Like the Torah is saying three ways to get married for a regular marriage, one way for a lover marriage. So clearly, the Torah, God is distinguishing between the two, and God is clearly making that distinction. He didn't leave it open that you could do with the other two. So if we believe this is from God, how could they overrule God's work?
Because God gave the mandate. God gave them the mandate. They're psukim, they're verses in the Torah that say you have to listen to the rabbis, and you're not allowed to swerve from what they say. And so this was considered based on the times, and I don't think it got any better. It wasn't considered proper to enter into a relationship in that manner. That seems to be their focus.
What would disqualify a brother-in-law? And is there a hierarchy of? Let's say there's three brothers.
I think I don't have a source for this. I think it was oldest brother, the next man up.
Regardless of his own marital status.
Well, according to the Torah law, you could be married to two wives.
Right.
So if he only has one wife, he's still eligible. If he already had two wives, then he would not be eligible for yibum, but he could still do chalitza. And that's why nowadays you can have a situation where a man is married, and his brother is married. His brother passes away, and even though he's married, he has to perform. We will not allow him to perform yibum, but we will. But he'll perform chalitza, and even though he's married, he can perform chalitza. I was last year in yeshiva teaching, and I mentioned the idea of yibum and chalitza. And all of a sudden, this kid raises his hand. He's like, "Yeah, my dad did chalitza." Unfortunately, he was actually named after his uncle. His uncle had passed away. And his father was the oldest brother.
But this is all only relevant if the woman has not had a kid.
If the man who died did not have
the
a kid.
The man with his what?
With anybody.
With anybody.
Okay. Jewish.
Right. And what if the wife is known to be pregnant?
So then we can wait. That happens.
They would not need to do this.
Correct.
So the baby doesn't have to be born.
I don't think so. I think it's okay. But we if God forbid it happens, we'll double check with the authorities. So I was just always I was bothered when I found out about this because my reading of Rashi didn't get the full picture. So now we have the full picture. So what we're going to do now is we're going to start the Gemara. So if you take a look where it says...
Help me out briefly here. Where am I? Where are we in here?
In here. I've never seen this inside.
Okay.
But we will try our best.
I'm causing to find it.
Right there. Okay. Gemara.
Oh, there we go.
There we go.
I knew you were going to find it.
Capital letters. You can't...
Okay.
Okay. This is the Steins, the new Steinsaltz.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Beautiful.
And you can get... I mean, you can spend hours...
Okay.
Not get anywhere.
Right, okay. So we'll try to be somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
So the Gemara begins, Ha'isha Niknes. It's referencing the first two words of our Mishnah. That we said, Ha'isha Niknes, we phrased the entrance into marriage by saying, the woman is acquired. Ha'isha Niknes, the woman is acquired. The Gemara asks the following question. Why is it different that over here, in the chapter 1, we teach the phrase Ha'isha Niknes, the woman is acquired, and what's the difference over there, which is a reference to the beginning of the second chapter of this tractate, that we learn there, the man sanctifies, or betroths. Why is it that here we use a language of acquisition and there we use a language of sanctity? Meaning language should be, we should use the same language. It's only one chapter away. And why is there a language difference? That chapter 1 opens with a language of kinyan, acquisition, and chapter 2 opens with a language of kiddushin, which is sanctity, betrothal. So the Gemara gives the answer. Mishum dekabai lemisnei kesef. Because the author of our Mishnah wanted to teach us that the route, the pathway of money, works to affect a marriage. Giving something of value works. And that's why they wanted to use the word kinyan. That's because we're about to explain acquisition, and the businessmen at the table know, usually in all business acquisitions, what's involved? Money. That there's kesef. There's something of value. Sometimes it's money, sometimes it's a commodity, sometimes, but it's something of value. The acquisition equals money. And our Mishnah wanted to teach us that money works. And therefore, what did it do? It used the word kinyan. It used the word acquisition. Even though it could have used the word sanctity, it could have used the word ha'isha niskadeshes, it could have had that word and would have matched the second chapter. So the Gemara explains further, four lines up from the bottom. V'kesef minalon and money, where do we know that that works to affect the marriage? Minalan is looking for a source. Sometimes you'll see the words minalan or minahani mili. These are questions that the Gemara uses to ask, what's a biblical source for something? What's the biblical source? We always want to take it back to the five books of the Torah for it to be most authoritative. So v'kesef minalan. How do you know that kesef works? So gamar, we learn out a scriptural connection from two separate psukim using the same word. Kicha, kicha, the word kicha, which means to take. Kicha, kicha, miste Ephron. We learn it from the field of Ephron. For extra credit points, what's the field of Ephron?
That was the burial place.
The burial place of Sarah.
Yeah.
That Avram bought a field. Avram bought a field. And there, as we'll explain, the language of the pasuk used the word kicha.
It's a good thing you answered that. I was going to say Wrigley.
Mr. Division winner over here. Ksiv hacha, three lines up. Ksiv hacha, the pasuk says here, meaning by marriage. This is a pasuk that we learned in our introduction together. The pasuk says, ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a woman. That Hashem chose when he wrote the Torah to introduce us to marriage with the word kicha, lakach, to take. Uksiv hasam, the pasuk says over there, in Sefer Bereishis, in Parshas Chayisara, Perichav Gimel, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Avram says, Nasati Kesef Hasadeh, I have given the money for the field, Kach Mimeni, take the money from me, and then allow me to take the field. V'kicha Ikri Kinyan. And Kicha, a language of taking, implies, is called acquisition. Dichsiv, because we have another Pasuk. The Pasuk says a little bit later on, Hasada, the field, Asher Kana Avram, that Avram acquired. So clearly, kinyan means money. turn over the page just for one more line. Inami, alternatively, there's another pasuk that shows us that acquisition can be money. Inami, there's a pasuk in Sefer Yirmiyahu, in the book of Jeremiah, Sados Bakesef Yiknu. Field with money you should acquire. So therefore, after hearing all these psukim, we conclude this piece by saying, Tani Hayisha Niknes. That's why the Mishnah, author of our Mishnah, chose to use the word Kenyan to tell us that she's entering into the marriage, because they wanted to teach us Kesef. They wanted to teach us that money can work to affect it. How could you teach us that? By using the word Kenyan. You teach us acquisition. Now we have psukim. We have psukim that back up. There's a scriptural connection. It's called a gzeira shava. That we have, if we have a word in one area of the Torah and a similar word in another area of the Torah, if, and this is a big capital I and F, if there was a tradition to connect the two, then you could learn laws from one to the other. You can't just get up and say, oh, because it uses the word low by Shabbos and uses the word low by Sukkos, that when Shabbos falls on Sukkos, you don't have to keep Shabbos. You know, because it has the word low and low. And if you want to stand up at Shalashuddis or at your son's bar mitzvah or grandson's bris and give a Dvar Torah that has, it talked about this in the parsha that he was born, and it talks about this in the parsha that he's getting married, you want to say a Shalashuddis Torah? Go ahead. You can say, you know, you have, as long as it's not heretical, you have license. But to halachically say we're going to connect the two is only if there was a tradition that was passed on. Like one of the most famous, this is called the Gzeira Shava. One of the most famous ones is, it's called Tesvav, 15-15. The fact that when the Torah introduces us to Pesach, it calls it Chamisha Asar, the 15th day of Nisan. And when the Torah introduces us to Sukkos, it uses the word Chamisha Asar, the 15th. And there was a tradition to connect the two, so we learned some laws. The same way that on the first night of Pesach, we all have a biblical mitzvah to eat a piece of matzah, to eat a kazayis of matzah, so too, on the first night of Sukkos, we have a biblical obligation to eat a piece of bread. Now you might say, oh, we always have, on Yom Tov, we always eat. It means we have an extra special obligation to eat in the sukkah a piece of bread. And that's why you always know, the rabbi always gives us a class, just in case, or a shiur, in case, God forbid, in America there's rain. You know what happened? What do you do different on the first night than all the other nights?
You don't go into the sukkah.
You wait it out. You wait it out. Let's say you're waiting it out. What do you do? At some point, you go into the rain.
Right.
Why are you going into the rain? You schnook. It's raining. It's because of this connection. It's because we have this special obligation because of this 15-15 connection. That just like you can't go through Pesach night without eating a piece of matzah, so too you can't go through Sukkos night without eating in the sukkah. So that's a gzeira. So here we have a gzeira shava.
And this is all passed out orally, the kesef and kesef?
Correct. The kicha. The take, kicha. Kicha mistei Ephron. If you want to impress someone, you'll tell them you're learning Kiddushin, you just have that catchphrase. Kicha mistei Ephron. Kicha. Sounds like pizza. Kicha. That, you know, you can remember it that way. So there's a connection that by stay Ephron, by when Avram bought a land, he bought it with money. He bought the field. And the other pasuk that's brought down, which we'll discuss, Yirmiyahu Anavi was told, a very beautiful thought. He was told, even though he was the prophet who prophesied about the destruction of the land of Israel during the end of the first temple period, at the end of the first Beis HaMikdash, Hashem told him, buy land. Even though you're going to be exiled to Babylonia, why should you buy land? Because you're coming back. You only buy land in a place that you're being exiled from if you're going to come back. And he kept the deed to the land. And that's this pasuk of Sados Bakesef Yiknu. It was a mandate God told him, and it was to show the Jewish people that yes, you're going to be punished, you're going to be exiled, but you're going to come back. So, here's a question. We just proved that kesef, that money.
I'll be right back. It's got page.
We just proved that money works on a level, biblical level, right? We connected it to psukim. Mm-hmm. Take a look at source number 3 on your sheet. The Rambam, in his laws, his Hilchos Ishus, makes a very a statement that just causes you to ponder. Rambam writes. It's very the beginning of Ishus, Perek Aleph, Halacha Beis. V'likuchen elu, the taking, this taking, which is the taking of marriage, mitzvahs asei shel Torah. We learned this phrase already, that it's a positive commandment. It's a mitzvah. The same way there's a mitzvah to put on tefillin, if a person wants to get married, it's a mitzvah to get married in this following way. U've'echad mishlosha dvarim ha'yishaniknis. And in one of three ways a woman can be acquired. B'kesef u'b'shtar u'b'bia. With kesef, shtar, u'b'bia. So far, nothing new. No, we don't have any questions. Listen to the following words. B'bia u'b'shtar, if a guy chooses the root of bia, or the root of shtar, min ha'torah. That works, min ha'torah. U'v'kesef, but if he uses the root of money, midivrei sofrim. That is what a category called divrei sofrim. Now, divrei sofrim would literally translate the words of the scribes. What it's clearly not is it's clearly not the same level as Torah. So the Rambam uses this phrase divrei sofrim in many places, and in some places he uses it as something we learn out not exactly from a biblical source. So this, when the Rambam says this, it's puzzling. How could the Rambam say that? When we just learned, it's the first page in the Masechta. If we learned the first page in the Masechta, don't worry. The Rambam learned the first page in the Masechta. He learned the whole Masechta. So how could he put the category of cat? And this is the one that we actually do. This is the way all of us got married this way. Every marriage we've ever been to has done through Kesef. Why would the Rambam define Kesef differently? So there was a great, the Rambam lived in the mid-1100s. And there was someone named the Ravid, Rav Avram ben David, who lived at the same time as the Rambam. And he went through the laws of the Rambam, and he argues on the Rambam very strongly at certain times when he thinks the Rambam is wrong. And most of the time he doesn't think the Rambam is wrong, but you know, every page or every other page he has a line. So if you take a look at the space in source number 3, it's called the Hasagas HaRavid, the attacks of the Ravid. So the Ravid says, he's quoting, "B'bia b'shtar min haTorah," that the root of bia and shtar is biblical. "B'kesef midivrei sofrim," and kesef is midivrei sofrim. Aleph is Amar Avram. This is where he's now. The Ravid, Rav Avram ben David, is talking. "Zeh shibush u'perish meshubash hayto." It's a mistake. The Rambam is wrong. It's a mistake. Either the Rambam is mistaken, or maybe somehow it got printed wrong. It's impossible to say this. That's how radical it is. He says it's a mistake. It's wrong, and he's very comfortable. He says he attacks the Rambam. You know, I'm sure I don't know if they ever met. I'm not that knowledgeable in history, but Talmid Chachamim, when they argue, they're pretty fierce. When they close their books, they're best of friends. But when they're arguing about law, they can be very fierce. So how do we make sense of the Rambam? So if you open up a page of Rambam, you'll see that there are many commentaries written on the Rambam. And one of the main commentaries written on the Rambam is called the Kesef Mishnah. The Kesef Mishnah was written by Rabbi Yosef Cairo, the same one who wrote the Shulchan Aruch that we read about in Source 2. Before he ever wrote his own book, he wrote commentaries on other people's books. And one of the main things he wrote a running commentary on all 14 volumes of the Rambam. The Rambam's book is called Mishnah Torah. That's the Rambam, that's his title of his book. Mishnah Torah means a review of the Torah, because he goes through all law from A to Z. So he wrote a commentary on the Rambam. He called it Kesef Mishnah, the silver that adorns the Mishnah Torah. So he tries, whenever anybody attacks the Rambam, he wants to defend the Rambam. He's living, Rav Yosef Cairo is living about 280 years approximately after the Rambam. But he always wants to defend the Rambam. So he says as follows, source 4. This is Rav Yosef Cairo talking. Be'echad mishlosh devarim, be'bia b'shtar min haTorah b'kesef midivrei sofrim. All he's doing is citing from the Rambam, that the Rambam said that the root of bia and shtar is biblical, but kesef is called divrei sofrim. Zeh davar kasheh, he writes. This is very hard. Heich kasov sha kesef midivrei sofrim. How in the world does the Rambam writing that Kesef is only midivrei sofrim? Shairi lamadnu, we learn kedusha Kesef kicha kicha mistei Ephron. The Kesef Mishnah is saying we learned it, and tonight we together here we learned it also. V'chol davar halnilmad meachas miyud gimel midos havidvar Torah. anything that's learned out from, you know, at the end of the Karbanos in the morning before they say the Kaddish, so there's something called Rabbi Shmuel Omer. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, we say it. What are we saying? Rabbi Shmuel Omer are the principles, the rules that the Torah can be expounded. Once upon a time, rabbis sat in a Beis Medrash, in the times of the Mishnah, they would open up a Chumash, they would look at the Chumash, and they would use certain rules to expound the Chumash. One of those rules is Gezeirah Shavah. One of the rules is that you can connect to Psukim. And those are biblical laws. So how is the Rambam not saying it's biblical? So after asking the question, Rav Yosef Karo provides a defense. Umasha Kasav Rabbeinu, the fact that Rabbeinu, our master, is meaning the Rambam, the fact that he wrote it's Midivrei Sofrim, Hu min HaShoresh HaSheni, it's from his second Shoresh, his second root, Shehini Acharav B'Sefer HaMitzvos. The Rambam, before he wrote his book of law, the Rambam wrote almost like an introductory work. He wanted to write down the list of the 613 mitzvahs. But how do you write a list of the 613 mitzvahs? What do you first have to do? You first have to write the rules and regulations, what makes something a mitzvah. And so in the beginning of the Rambam's work, known as Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam has 14 sharashim, 14 roots, like a shorish, like a 14 roots, 14 principles that you got to hit all 14 in order to be a mitzvah, in order to be considered of the 613. So there, if you go look there, the Rambam explains that the only way he's going to count a mitzvah being a part of the 613 is if it is explicit in the Torah. If it has to be learned through inferences, you'll have to keep it on a biblical level, but it's not considered to be part of the 613. And one of the reasons why that might be is because if a rabbi comes along and on his own, let's say in the times of the Gemara, a Rav came along on his own and made a decree to protect the Torah. So the only way we could get rid of that decree is if the current court of rabbis is greater in quality than that old rabbinic court, which really it can't really happen anymore. That's if the rabbi made a decree as a rabbinic decree. The Rambam's of the opinion that if the rabbi, the group of Rabbanim, made the law by using those rules to expound the Torah, and in a separate generation, the rabbis of the generation came and used those same rules and found a different root, a different explanation, then they could actually uproot the original explanation and go with the new explanation. So that's why the Rambam...
New explanation or a new rule?
New rule based on their explanation. Not rule to expound, but rule that would come out of their teaching. So how could you have that? How could you have that be part of the 613 if it can change? The 613 are unchangeable. They can never change, right? Tefillin can never change. Tefillin is very explicit. You have to put an os al yadcha. You have to put a sign on your hand. Totafos. Obviously, it's a hard word to translate. Beinei necha. But tefillin is there. Mezuzah is there. It says you have to put a mezuzah on your door. Those are mitzvahs. Here, the Rambam is going to say that kesef, since it was learnt out from the connection of kicha kicha, it counts. No one has to go home and tell their wife they're married only rabbinically. Doesn't mean that they're married rabbinically. Divrei Sofrim doesn't mean rabbinically, but it means something that the rabbis learned. It means we keep it as a biblical law, but it's not part of the 613. And that's how the Kesef Mishnah defended the Rambam. So in the Kesef Mishnah's opinion, when the Ravid says the Rambam's mistaken, hold off, Ravid, don't jump. We have an explanation for the Rambam. We can defend him. That has to do with his big theory on how you count mitzvahs.
What was the name of the volume that he wrote, that Rambam wrote about the sort of preliminary?
It's called Sefer HaMitzvos. Sefer HaMitzvos. And it's a fascinating work to read because it actually counts out what are the 613 mitzvahs. I'm always fascinated. Maybe I mentioned it in a different shiur. There's only, we mentioned it, I don't know, last week, there's only one, or the first one, there's only one line in the whole Gemara that mentions the idea that there's 613 mitzvahs. You would think, it's such an important idea, maybe it's one line at the end of Maseches Makos. However, every single Rishon takes it seriously. They literally sweat and toil to figure out the 613. And after the Rambam made his list of the 613, the Ramban, who lived pretty much at the same time, attacked him and said, you left this out? He lists all the things that he thinks the Rambam left out. If he thinks the Rambam left it out, well, he has to take out something else because you have to get 613. It's like this. And we know Taryag. We know we have so many gematrias about the Tzitzis is Taryag. Everything we know. There's a band called 613. Every other shul. I mean, no one's listening. You know, you could always break into a shul. Most shuls' code to get in is something with 613. It's ridiculous. But the
The doctor's phone closet.
Ours is 5132.
It's 513.
Right.
Where do they?
Everybody listening is welcome to come to our shul.
Where does the original 613 come from?
This Gemara.
From the
Darash Reb Simlai. Yeah.
It says the 613.
Nowhere in the Torah does it say the 613.
So this one rabbi says the 613, and then everyone's trying to find what the 613.
Right. I would imagine that because we take it so seriously, that this was something that was passed down, and a tradition that was had, and it was finally recorded in the Gemara in Makos. It was something that was passed. It was passed down. And there are these beautiful inferences. The fact that we have, apparently there are 248 positive mitzvahs and 365 negative mitzvahs. And the 248 positive mitzvahs correspond to the limbs in a body. I know we have some doctors around, so I don't know if the medical field defines limb the same way that Chazal did, but you can somehow, a loose definition that there are 248 limbs in the body. And the positive mitzvahs, many of the positive mitzvahs, you have to do it. So you're doing it with your body. The 365 negative mitzvahs are either correspond to the 365 days in a solar year, which needs some more explanation because usually we're much more lunar than solar. Why would that be? I don't have a good explanation for that. We have to do more research. And the other one is that I take medical, without medical knowledge, that there are 365 sinews in the body. What that means, not sure. But again, it corresponds to the body. The Chafetz Chaim, actually, who wrote the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is six volumes that are written on one section of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch's section of Aruch Chaim, of daily laws, so the Mishnah Berurah, the Chafetz Chaim, or Yisrael Meir Kagan HaKohen, who died in 1933, there's still, till a couple of years ago, there was a Rebbe in YU who saw the Chafetz Chaim. He saw the Chafetz Chaim in his yeshiva. He passed away. He was over 100 when he passed away. So we still had. I mean, I met someone who met the Chafetz Chaim. It's not that far. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote an introduction to his first volume, and he writes an introduction to the third volume. The third volume is devoted all to Shabbos. He writes that this Gemara, which mentions that the mitzvahs relate to the body. He says, I don't know if it's his idea or it's based on, he says that when a person performs mitzvos, so when they're invited to come back after they die and after they come back to life, so if they kept the mitzvah that corresponds to that limb, they'll get that limb back. But if they didn't, then they might not. And he said certain mitzvahs are not as important limbs as others. He said Shabbos is one of those limbs. You know, there's certain organs, there's certain parts of the body that if a person doesn't have it, the person will not live. You know, so Shabbos, whether it's a brain, whether it's a heart, that's Shabbos. There was a lot of paying attention to this Gemara saying that there are 613 mitzvahs. So let's see one more point. Perhaps we could get it in. If you turn on the second side of the Gemara sheet, the first Tosfos on the sheet, Tosfos is on the outside of the page, which is here. The heading is Inami. On the flip side, Inami. So Tosfos is bothered by has an implicit question. Why did we need to use two psukim when we proved that a field can be acquired? So we quoted a pasuk about Avram from Sefer Bereishis, which is in the Torah, and then we quoted a pasuk from Yirmiyahu, which is in the Navi. Now, it's well known that in order for you to prove something, You want to try to prove it from the five books of the Torah. That's how, that's called d'oraisa. That's called biblical. Anything that's in the Navi or in the Ksuvim, it has validity, but not to the same level. It can't be considered to be a mitzvah. It can't be considered to be one of the 613 if the only source for it is in Nevi'im or in the Ksuvim, right? We have a lovely holiday that many people enjoy called Purim, but it's not a biblical holiday. Why? Because you could start from the book of Bereishis, go all the way to the end of Devarim, never going to find Purim. Where's Purim mentioned? In Megillas Esther. So therefore, it's a rabbinic holiday. And we're good Jews, so we keep rabbinic holidays, but it's not the same thing. If there's a conflict, it's not that, you know, you have to always go with what's biblical over what's rabbinic. So why would they choose to mention a pasuk from Yirmiyahu? And the other part of Tosfos' question is that there's another pasuk that seems to be even better. Take a look. Tosfos writes, "V'ha delo maisi kinyan shenichtav b'Torah." The fact that it didn't bring the idea of acquisition from what's written in the Torah of the following phrase, mikesef miknaso, from money, from his acquisition. That's a pasuk in Vayikra, Perichav Hey. Why didn't the Gemara use that pasuk? That seems to be so obvious. It mentions, in two words, it says kesef and kinyan. That'll teach us that kesef equals acquisition. So Tosfos answers, Mishum deboy lasuye kinyan desada. It was because the Gemara was trying to teach us an acquisition of a field. And this pasuk from the book of Vayikra is actually talking about the acquisition of a slave. If you take a look, I actually have it on the source sheet for you. In source number 5, I printed out the whole pasuk for you, where the pasuk says, if let's say we know that when a Jewish slave is sold, so there's always an option that he can be redeemed. He could be redeemed by a relative. Let's say a relative comes along and says, I want to redeem my slave. So pasuk says, im od rabos bashanim lefihen yashiv gulaso. If there are more years on the contract, so according to those years, he'll pay his redemption, mikesef miknaso, and it'll come off the value of his original acquisition. So this is talking about acquiring slaves. That's not going to work for us because we're trying to. We would much rather go with acquiring a field. The Tosfos continues, and he says, "V'kasha imkain havali lasuya hasada asher kana Avram." Why not only have the pasuk from Bereishis about Avram buying the field? Why did you also need that pasuk from Yirmiyahu? Usually, when the Gemara gives an inami, when it gives an alternative answer, it means perhaps that there's something deficient with the first answer. But what's deficient with the first answer? Avram bought a field. He bought it with money. It's called a kinyan. So Tosfos explains that v'yesh lomar d'me'ahi lek lamedak. From the pasuk of Avram alone, you might not have been able to determine that he bought the field with money, that the acquisition was with money. The ikal ameimar hasad asher kana Avram b'chazaku b'shtar. You might have been able to say that the way he acquired the field is maybe he acquired the field with a document, and he just gave the money as a support to his act of acquisition was with a document, or was with what's called chazaka, where the owner gives him permission to start working on the field, to start digging in the field. I don't go into your backyard and dig, right? You'd call the cops and arrest me. So if I'm digging in your backyard, it probably means that you gave me a portion of the backyard. You gave me permission to be in your backyard. So a chazaka is doing something to the field. So it's missing the component of kesef. It appears that Tosfos is explaining that the Gemara wanted to get a pasuk that hits on all themes. The theme of asada, the theme of kesef, and the theme of kinyan. Those are the three words they wanted. And the pasuk of Avram only has two of them. The pasuk in Yirmiyahu has all three. And so as a appendage, as a hint, that we're going to group the pasuk about Avram, Inami, there's a pasuk in Yirmiyah that maybe isn't the sole source, but it's a support. And that's why Tosfos concludes, Daloksiv hasada asher kana bekesef. It never said that Avram acquired the field with kesef. He uses the word kesef, he uses the word kinyan, but it never has that in the same verse. Pasuk in Yirmiyah has all three in the same verse, which will teach us that the act of acquisition can be accomplished with money. And we translate that back to what our discussion is, that marriage, the acquisition of marriage, can be accomplished through money. And Bez Shem, we'll continue this thought.
Questions on this, though?